Yeah, we were learning the mitzvah of Parah Adumah, and the fact that it's a chok, a very unique chok. So just to finish up with one halachic point that I mentioned, there is a machlokas in the Gemara if non-Jewish graves are mitamei bi'ohel, meaning if I touch the body or I move the body, I do become tamei for 7 days. But if I'm in the same roof as the body, or I go into a cemetery, so I'm putting my body over the kever, is there tuma? The Shulchan Aruch, it's machlekes in the Gemara, but the Shulchan Aruch is machmir, and the Ramah is mekel, but the Ramah says it's better to be machmir anyway. So the Shulchan Aruch says it is usher, the Ramah says there's a basis to be lenient, but it, even like the Ramah, it's better to be machmir. As a result, our custom is that a Kohen does not enter a non-Jewish cemetery. That is the minhag that we have. So it's very interesting that if you look in back of the Kotel, meaning to say on the other side of the Old City, facing the Mount of Olives, right? So it's facing what is called Nachal Kidron, the Kidron Valley, and then you have Harizesim. And the gate to the east of the Kotel is a closed off gate. It's called the Golden Gate, the Shar Hazav, and it's not a Jewish gate. It was actually constructed by Muslims. But there is a Messiah that Mashiach will enter Yerushalayim from Har HaZeisim and go through that gate. That gate is going to be opened, and Mashiach will enter via the Har HaBayis. So you may notice that right up to the Golden Gate, there is a very small ancient Islamic cemetery. There is an Arab cemetery there. And the story that they tell is that the Muslims thought they would prevent the coming of Mashiach. How is that so? Because before Mashiach can come, Eliyahu HaNavi comes to announce the coming of Mashiach, and he too will go through that gate. Eliyahu HaNavi, on the other hand, is a Kohen. He's a Gilgal of Pinchas, the Kohen. And therefore they figured if we put a cemetery there, Pinchas will not be able to enter the Golden Gate, and if he will not enter the Golden Gate, then Mashiach will not be able to come either. This was their cheshbon, and this is why they put a cemetery right there. Now the cheshbon is a krum cheshbon, number one, because at least, well, it depends if you pass like the Mechaber or the Ramah, but at least like the Ramah, it's a krum cheshbon, because Pinchas could go through a non-Jewish cemetery. But besides that, you know, this is not going to stop the coming of Mashiach. If Mashiach Eliyahu doesn't go through the Golden Gate, there'll be some other way. You know, it doesn't have to be that way in particular. But it's interesting that you see that even the enemies of the Jews had a deep belief in the teachings of Chazal, and they thought that they could actually frustrate the coming of Mashiach that way. But there is a tshuva of the Nedav Yehuda. The Nedav Yehuda wants to say the following. Nedav Yehuda wants to say that even like the Shulchan Aruch, there is a logical heter why a Kohen could go into a non-Jewish cemetery. And he developed this based on the concept of sfeik sfeika. This is a very important principle in halacha. Normally, if you're not sure if something is mutter or usser, and it's a Torah prohibition, so there's a principle called sfeik teoraisa l'chumra. Any doubt regarding a Torah law, you have to be strict. But that's only if it's a single doubt. If something is called a double doubt, meaning in order to say something's usher, you have to resolve two separate doubts in a strict way, there we say you could be lenient even on an isser d'oraisa. This is called the principle of a double doubt. So he points out, on the issue of a Kohen entering a non-Jewish cemetery, we actually have a double doubt. Doubt number one is, do we paskin it's usher or mutter, meaning it's a suffix. According to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, it is permitted. According to the other Chachman D'Amar, it's prohibited, and therefore it's at least a suffix. Now, if it would just be one suffix, we would have to be strict. But then he says there's another suffix, and that is the shita of the Ravid. The Ravid has an opinion, which we don't paskin like in and of itself, that since Bizman Hazeh, everybody is already Tamei, one way or the other, and they have no way of getting Tahor, so there is no prohibition of a Kohen entering even a Jewish cemetery today, because you're already Tamei. If you're already Tamei, you can't become more Tamei. Now, the Ravid's an amazing leniency. According to the Ravid, I mean, understand what the Ravid is saying. The Ravid is saying there is no Isser Bizman Hazeh of a Kohen going into any cemetery, even a Jewish cemetery. Now, we certainly don't paskin like the Ravid. We don't allow a Kohen to go into a Jewish cemetery. But because the Ravid does have such a view, we can at least use him to make a double doubt. So our double doubt is, first of all, maybe it was always mutter to go to a non-Jewish cemetery. And even if you're going to be machmir and say you can't go to a non-Jewish cemetery, but maybe the issur doesn't apply to a person who's already tameh. So therefore, the Neid of Yehuda wants to say that even if in the time of the Gemara we would be strict and not allow a Jew to go into a non-Jewish cemetery, b'zman hazeh, when everybody is tameh, you could be mitztaref, you could combine the shitas haravid to make a sveik sveika. Now this was the Neid of Yehuda's hava amina, but he was then chozer for the following reason. He was chozer because many interpretations understand that the Ravid did not permit a Kohen to go into a cemetery today. He simply said a Kohen would not get lashes, a Kohen wouldn't get malchus, but there's still a Torah prohibition. If that is the case, you can't use the Ravid as any basis of leniency. The Ravid would say it's usher. You only have one suffix. Do I paskin like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai that the Goyim is permitted or not? Okay. So the bottom line of Neid of Yehuda is that a Kohen should not go into a non-Jewish cemetery, Bizman Hazeh. Okay. Now, what is the derivation of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai that non-Jews are not metame in Ohel, like his opinion? So basically, it's based on this verse. Zos HaTorah, this is the Torah, Adam ki yamus b'ayel. When a person dies in the tent, everyone that goes into the tent is tameh. So he darshins this way. Since the tumah is predicated on Adam ki yamus b'ayel, if an Adam dies in a tent, so he has a drasha, atem keruyim Adam. Only you, the Jewish people, are called Adam, are called mankind. Ein Avdei Kechavim Keruyim Adam. So when the Torah says Adam, it means only the Jew. It excludes non-Jews. So for many, many hundreds of years, non-Jews or anti-Semites have looked at that Gemara and says, oh, so we see that the Jewish people do not consider non-Jews to be people. They're only animals. Because you're making a drasha. Adam, atem kruyim adam, v'ein avdei kechavim kruyim adam. Which means, that seems to be saying goyim are animals. So the emes is that I'll give you two explanations, which it's not quite as negative as that as it sounds. One explanation Rav Hirsch simply says, that is, Adam is, of course, Adam HaRishon. And Adam HaRishon, that Zerach Hashem explains, although Rav Hirsch doesn't quote Zerach Hashem, that originally the notion of bringing God into the world was a universal mission, meaning mankind was given the mission. But eventually, mankind as a whole proved unable to do that, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu chose a certain branch, namely the Jewish people, to have that mission. So really, the Jewish people have the mission that Adam HaRishon was originally given. So when we darshan, Atem Kruyim Adam, you are called Adam, we don't mean you are called human and other people are not called human. That's not what it means. Rather, you are called Adam. You have the mission of Adam HaRishon, right? The mission that was originally given to Adam HaRishon now becomes the mission of Am Yisrael. So it's really a description of a mission. It is not saying you're human and they're not human. Rather, the job that Hashem had given to Adam, had he not sinned, would have been the job, is now the job that belongs to Am Yisrael, to spread godliness and Kedusha into the world. That's one explanation. But there's another explanation from the Tiferes Yisrael, which is traces one of the commentaries on the Mishnah written in the 19th century, Rabbi Yisrael Lipschitz in Germany. And he brings a very strange Tisus, which is very hard to understand. Tisus points out that when it says Adam alone, that just means Jews and not Goyim. But when it says Ha'adam, that includes non-Jews. So it depends on the lashon of the pasuk. Ha'adam includes everybody. Adam only includes Jews. What is the difference between Ha'adam and Adam? Actually, this would fit in with the first explanation as well. Ha'adam just means human beings, and Goyim are human beings. Adam is Adam HaRishon, and the Jews are compared to Adam HaRishon, but not for the reason I said a moment ago, but for a different reason. It actually points out a potential mila that non-Jews might have, and that is the following. He says, if you look at Adam HaRishon, Adam HaRishon came into the world with everything that he needed. He was created fully mature, fully intelligent, fully developed. He did not come into the world as a baby, as a child, who had to grow up and learn things. Adam HaRishon came into this world in shlemus. He was mekalkel through the chait, but he came into the world in utter perfection. So the Jewish people are like Adam, because at Matan Torah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us everything we need. We did not have to acquire morality or wisdom gradually. That's why we say Niskatnu Hadoros. That's as we get further and further from Matan Torah, we have less understanding because we're further and further from the source of all wisdom. As opposed to the nations of the world, they do have an idea of progress and advance because they were like little babies, right? Coming from a lack of civilization to learning more about science, more about technology, more about mathematics, whatever it would be. So when it says, you are called Adam, and of the Kachavim are not called Adam, it's actually making the point, you became a nation in a fully developed way, the same way Adam HaRishon became a person in a fully developed way, as opposed to the Umos HaOlam, who have to go through a developmental process. So it's not pejorative at all. If anything, you could say this is kind of an optimistic version, really, and it is connected in a sense to what you might call 19th century Romanticism, which did exist in Germany pre-Holocaust, in which human beings would just get better and better and better and better in the passage of time. And therefore the Ovdei Kochavim would start off as primitives and they would get better and better and better. And there wasn't, in fact, that is called Romanticism, kind of this eternal improvement of the human race. Unfortunately, I think the Holocaust later on in Germany, around 100 years later, showed us that that was an overly optimistic hashara. But this is how the Tiferes Yisrael learns, Atem Kriyim Adam, that you came into the world, you became a nation like Adam HaRishon, as opposed to the Umos HaOlam that get better with the passage of time, because there is an idea of spiritual progress, you know, democracy, freedom, giving rights, getting rid of slavery, right? These were moral developments in a secular world that Am Yisrael did not have to go through because we were given the wisdom of the Torah all the way back. They tell the story that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was once on a plane with a very, very prominent secular Jewish leader. And Rav Yaakov's grandchildren were also on the plane, but they were sitting further back. And every 15 minutes they were coming to him, asking him if he needed something. You know, they were showing him great, great kavod. So the Jewish leader said to him, you know, it's very amazing. My grandchildren don't treat me that way. And what is your secret that your grandchildren come to you with so much derech eretz? So Rav Yaakov said, well, it's very, very simple. We believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us all of the chachma at Matan Torah, and things just go downhill from there. So as a result, anyone that's closer to Matan Torah is closer to the source of wisdom. So the later generations will respect the earlier generations because the earlier generations come from a superior, higher place. But from a secular standpoint, you believe in evolution, man comes from ape, or whatever it is. So fakert, the older the generation, the closer they are to anarchy, to barbarism, to being an animal. And the later generations are more sophisticated, they're higher. So of course the later generations are going to have less respect for the older generations, because the older generations are closer to the lowly source from which everything comes. So it all depends on whether you start off high, and then you can lose it, or you start off low and then you can raise yourself. So the Tiferet Yisrael sees in what looks like a very negative statement against non-Jews an actual affirmation the other way, that non-Jews can improve themselves by raising themselves in level. Yeah.
It's almost the same. Yiras Deris doesn't apply to Goyim.
Well, no, that's what Tiferet Yisrael is actually saying. Yiras Deris does not apply to Goyim. That because Goyim did not have the experience of Matan Torah, so consequently they're in a mode of discovering new truths of which they were not aware, as opposed to Am Yisrael, which unfortunately all we can do is lose. It's a bit pessimistic. We can only lose what we already had, and then we have to try to recapture it or hold on to it or rediscover it and the like. Now the truth of the matter is, this is a very, very complicated question that gets into a lot of controversy, in which even within Klal Yisrael, Rav Kook and Rav Tzadok talk about the idea that we do discover new truths within the framework of Torah that were not always understood. That there is an idea, for example, that when the Torah permitted slavery, and the Torah permitted polygamy, and then we find in later generations these practices were abandoned, there is a concept Rav Kook articulates that on some level, although spiritually we descend, on some level we can sometimes reach higher spiritual perceptions, and it's the will of God that although he could not prohibit certain things at certain times, but as society develops, the Chachamim will prohibit it because of a higher evolving moral consciousness. That's a very, very interesting idea. It's a controversial idea, and it seems to contradict to some degree Yerida Sadaros, but Rav Kook and Rav Tzadok do talk about that as well. Polygamy is seen not simply as a rabbinic enactment, but it's actually seen as an evolution of a higher moral sense, which the Jewish people were not ready for at a given time in history. But that's, they say, that is a matter that many, many would dispute. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about that. One more thing, let's go back to the very beginning of the Parsha. Zos Chukas HaTorah. This is the Chok, the inexplicable law of the Torah. So here we have a small question, but there's some interesting discussions about it. That is, since the only mitzvah that's being discussed is the mitzvah of Parah Aduma, why does it call it the Chok of the Torah? It should just say the Chok of the Parah, Zos Chukas HaParah. By calling it Chukas HaTorah, you're implying that this is somehow a law that pertains to the whole Torah. How does it pertain to the whole Torah? Zos Chukas HaTorah. So there are a number of terutzim that are given. The Orach Chaim points out that Tuma is a function of the Kedusha that existed when something was alive. In other words, the greater the Kedusha, the greater the vacuum and the greater the impurity when the Kedusha is nistalik. That is why, indeed, the Tumah of a dead Jew is greater than the Tumah of a dead Goy, like Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. That is why the Tumah of any human being is greater than the Tumah of an animal, which is only a Tumah of one day. That is why the Tumah of an animal is greater than the Tumah of a plant. A plant is not tame in and of itself. A plant could become tame through contact with an animal and the like, and a rock cannot even become tame indirectly. Because once again, Tuma is the vacuum that is created when Kedusha leaves. And when there's less Kedusha, there is less impurity. It's a correlation. So consequently, the Orach Chaim says that's exactly what the Torah means. As the Torah introduces the Parsha of Tuma, so it says, this Chok comes from the Torah. That which Jewish dead have such a strict level of Tuma is because of the holiness of the Torah, which when it creates a vacuum, creates a greater Tumah. That's what the Orach Chaim says. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz makes a different point. And he says the following. He says that the way you measure what a person's attitude towards the Torah is how do they feel towards Chukim. Because the parts of the Torah that make sense, right? There's a lot of the Torah that makes sense. A lot of the Torah I understand. A lot of the Torah is accessible to me. But if I keep the mitzvahs because they make sense, am I doing it because I'm serving Hashem? Or am I doing it because it makes sense to me? You don't really know. But the attitude of the person who says that even the mitzvos that make no sense to me, I am going to do because it's the Ratzon Hashem, that reveals the fact that all the other mitzvos he's doing is because of God and not because of him. That's why it says, Zos Chukas HaTorah. His attitude towards the irrational defines his attitude towards all the mitzvos of Hashem. Because in reality, all the mitzvos we do, not because they make sense to us, even not killing, right? The attitude is supposed to be, the reason I don't kill somebody is not because it makes sense to me not to kill. I don't kill because this is the Ratzon Hashem, that I don't kill people. So therefore, the attitude you have towards the chok is the definition of what your attitude is towards the entire Torah. Zos Chukas HaTorah. Then he makes another point, which is really related, and that is, a chok is a lesson in obedience. It doesn't make sense to me, I just don't understand it, I do it anyway. And a human being rebels against chok. Human beings rebel against authority. We don't like being told what to do. He brings such a fascinating raya. He says, you know, there was a man, if you learned the book of Shemuel, Beis, and Melachim. So when David HaMelech was being pursued by his own son, Avshalom, and Avshalom wanted to kill his father, Avshalom wanted to become king. So as David is running away from Yerushalayim, he's trying to escape. So there's a man, Shimi ben Gera, who is part of Shaul's family. And Shimi ben Gera is cursing David and throwing rocks at David and saying, now Hashem is punishing you for all that you did to our relative Shaul, who was the real king. And Yoav ben Tzruya, David's faithful general, wanted to kill Shimi ben Gera. And David HaMelech uttered the famous words that if Hashem did not want me to be humiliated, this would not have happened. I have to accept this as a punishment from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Shimi ben Gera was spared. But strangely enough, in the beginning of Malachim, when David is on his deathbed, this is very peculiar, when David is on his deathbed, he gives Shlomo HaMelech some instructions. And one of the instructions he gives Shlomo HaMelech is, figure out a way to kill Shimi ben Gera because he cursed me. Entrap him. I can't kill him because of the insult, because I already said I wasn't going to kill him for that, but make up some pretense. Now that itself is very, very problematical, because this seems to cancel out the righteousness of David. I mean, David HaMelech made a whole point of saying, he's cursing me, it must be from God, I accept it. He then tells Shlomo HaMelech privately, be sure and get him. Like, you know, what's going on? So again, it's an interesting question, and it's a difficult question, but one teretz might be that Shimi ben Gera surely deserved to die because he was a moreid b'malchus, he was rebelling against David, he's chayev misa. But David didn't want to kill him in the heat of the moment, because then he would have been acting out of anger, he wouldn't have been acting l'shem shemayim. So David had to wait until he no longer felt resentment or anger in his heart. And then he could say objectively he deserves to die. In other words, there's a very big difference between, you insulted me, so I'm going to kill you, because I'm acting out of anger, and a person who thinks a long time and then says, this person must die because he was a moreid b'malchus. Yeah.
Why did he have to find another pretext to
go? Right. Yes, that's a good question. So why couldn't he just say, get him now? Because apparently the concept would be that overall it seemed like a promise, wasn't it?
David HaMelech gave another pretext why he wanted to kill him. He thought
that he'll like... No, but he told Shlomo to find another pretext. We'll see.
Shlomo kill him because of a certain reason. Yep. Shlomo couldn't kill him because he cursed Shlomo. They didn't curse Shlomo.
No, but he couldn't have killed him because he cursed David. There's no rule that a Moreid B'Malchus is off the hook when the old king dies. I mean, he could have killed him for the old reason. Yeah. It must be that since it would have looked like either a revenge or a chilul Hashem, if after David said not to kill him, you know, Shlomo did, you know, so there has to be a pretext. Now, what was the pretext, though? This is the main point. The pretext was that David HaMelech told Shimi ben Gera that because of what you did to my father, I'm putting you under not even house arrest, city arrest. Don't leave this city. Stay in the city. And the day that you leave the city, I'm going to kill you because you're violating my new order. So now, he wasn't confined to a prison cell, and he wasn't even confined to his house. He was just saying, stay in the city. So the story goes that he had lost his donkeys, and he went looking for his donkeys. He wandered out of the city. Shlomo had men looking for him, and he was killed. So Rav Chaim Shulevitz said, what type of crazy person does this? A person is told by the king, you leave the city, you're chayav misa. And he didn't leave the city, you know, to go to a funeral or go, or, you know, some maid for donkeys. Shimi ben Gera was a wealthy person. He certainly could have had Avadim look for his donkeys. Why did he leave? And Rav Chaim Shulevitz used to say, you see from here, that had he not been told he couldn't leave, he wouldn't have left. He would have gotten his servants. But as soon as he is told, you can never leave the city again, it becomes unbearable. It becomes, ay vesmer, I'm suffocating, I'm dying here, I have to get out. This is the nature of a human being. That had there been no commandments, he would have been perfectly happy to be a stay at home. But when you're told you can't leave, we see this all the time with the Yitzharas. If a yeshiva has a rule, you know, don't go to certain places. You know, if there wouldn't be a rule, maybe you wouldn't even go there anyway. Once there's a rule, I gotta go, I gotta get out. So he makes the point that a human being cannot stand to be forced to do anything. We have a stubbornness within us. You'll see when you get married, you know, you're about to take the garbage out for your wife. This is human nature. You want to be a nice guy. And right when you're taking out the garbage, you know, your wife calls out from another room, please take out the garbage. There's going to be a little bit of a momentary, I shouldn't be too autobiographical, a little bit of a momentary stubbornness. You know, I don't like to be told what to do, you know. I mean, I would do it as a tzaddik, but I don't like to be, you know, I don't want to be told what to do. You know, and in fact, Tosfos in Avodah Zarah says a fascinating thing. You know, the Gemara says in Bava Kama, why do we make a bar mitzvah? Why is a bar mitzvah a simcha? Because until you were 13, you were doing mitzvahs on a voluntary basis. And now you're chayav. And we say, gadol ha-mitzvah v'yosa. When you do a mitzvah that you're commanded to do, that's greater than when you do a mitzvah that you're not commanded to do. So now that you become commanded, you make a simcha because you're mitzvah. Right? The Gemara says, you're mitzvah. So Tosha says, well, wait a second, isn't it the opposite the case? If I do a mitzvah that I have to do, so I have to do it. Why should I get so much reward? But if I do something I don't have to do, it's extra credit. Like we say, time and a half for overtime, right? If I just do my job in the normal working hours, I get paid a certain amount. If I do extra time, so for karek, and yet the Gemara seems to say, extra mitzvahs count less than obligatory mitzvahs. Why is that so? So Tosfos says quite beautifully, because once you have to do something, the Yetzer Hara tells you not to do it. Meaning the 12-year-old, sure, learn, daven, you know, everything's wonderful, bench. As soon as he becomes 13, the day of the bar mitzvah, do I have to, you know, this and that? Because the Yetzer, now it's true, I understand. There is a kasha, because the Hara, you might ask me from the Chazal, that says the Yetzer Hara comes to a person from the time that they are born. And the real Yetzer Tov does not enter a person until they're 13. There is such a chazal, and that is why the Yetzer Hara is called Melech Zokein Uksil, the old foolish king that tries to rule over you, because the Yetzer Hara is in you 13 years earlier than the true Yetzer Tov. There is such a chazal. It's a bit of a tzorachi, and I'll leave it as a question to think about. How do you reconcile that with what Tosfos says in Avodah Zarah, which actually moves in the opposite direction, saying, once you become commanded, the Yetzer Hara is much stronger. But be it as it may, the point that Rav Chaim Shmulevitz makes with all of this is that the Parah Aduma is pure obedience. It makes no sense. I'm not following my seichel. I'm following the seichel of Hashem. And it represents doing something only because you were commanded to do it. And that's that shows a person's attitude to the whole Torah, because a person does not want to be a what's called a muchrich. We don't like to take orders. That's kind of the rebellious. In fact, maybe the Jewish people are even worse than the non-Jews. This is why we are called Am Kishei Orif. We are a stubborn people. That is what the Torah, that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls us. But you understand, in many ways, that served the Jewish people very well. That allowed people to have emunah in spite of all the nations that tried to destroy us. That allowed us to keep the Torah even when we were threatened with death and even when many people were killed. So stubbornness is a very, very valuable quality, but it has a downside. We don't like to take orders. And therefore a person has to learn how to subjugate his nature to the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is why Gadol HaMetzuva V'Yaisa, and that is the Maila of a Chok. Right? A Chok is the notion that even when things don't make sense, I am a Kabel and I'm a Vato myself to the Ratzon Hashem. There is yet another explanation of why it's called Chukas HaTorah. We're all focusing on starting off with a small question. Why is it called the Chok of the Torah? And this is from an amazing comment of the Vilna Gaon in Mishlei. And this is a comment that I have gotten in trouble for saying, so I have to preface it that it is the Vilna Gaon, it's not me. People openly denied that the Vilna Gaon said this, but he did say this. But although I admit that it may need more explanation than the comment itself. And that is, we know that Torah is compared to water. Everybody knows that. Torah is compared to water. Now, why is Torah compared to water? So there are a lot of explanations. Water is necessary for life. Yeah, there's something here. Torah is necessary for life. Yeah, okay, there. Yeah. Torah is necessary for life. Water purifies. Torah purifies. Right? Different things. Water goes from high ground to low ground. The Torah leaves the arrogant and goes to the humble. Right? All of these are very familiar. But the Gra in Mishlei says something very, very surprising and unusual. He says, why is Torah compared to water? Because water creates growth based on whatever is planted in the ground, meaning to say the following. If I have a piece of soil, if there is wheat seed in the ground, the water will cause wheat to grow. If there are poisonous weeds in the ground, the water will cause weeds to grow. Water is indifferent as to what it produces. It has a kayach hatsamicha. It has the power of growth and rejuvenation. And if what comes out, what is planted, is good, it'll be good. If what is planted is bad, it will be bad. So the Gra said, now one thing, and the one thing you cannot accuse the Vilna Gaon of is not being machshiv the learning of Torah. The Vilna Gaon learned... the Vilna Gaon learned 22 hours a day. The Vilna Gaon only slept for much of his life. I don't know, not all of his life, but for much of his life, the Vilna Gaon only slept 2 hours a day, and he did so in no more than a half an hour at a time. He slept in 4 half-hour naps. And the Vilna Gaon, at the end of a year, was able to make a cheshbon of his Bittul Torah in terms of minutes, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and what was his 4 minutes of Bittul Torah? It wasn't Bittul Torah as we would define it. Anyway, in fact, they tell the story, just as an aside, I'll get back to his thought. They tell the story that the Vilna Gaon once went to a chasna, which he didn't do too often, and he was staying in a room, and he slept apparently 32 minutes instead of 30 minutes. And when he got up and he saw that he slept 2 extra minutes, he was sobbing and crying and wailing over the 2 minutes of Torah. And whenever the Gra would travel, it was so famous that people would pay to climb a ladder and watch him in his bedroom for a minute at a time. In other words, just watch him sleep, watch him learn, whatever it is. Like, you know, there would be a ladder, they would prop a ladder up to the window, and there was a, you know, for 1 ruble you can get a peek, you know, for 2 minutes, and then they pull you down. So somebody went up and sees the Vilna Gaon crying and sobbing, and it spread to the whole city. The whole city was subrachen, and the Vilna Gaon says, what a city this is. It wasn't Vilna, it was outside of Vilna. This is a sleepy city, a city of sleep, a city of batala. I can't come here again. And the whole city was sad, and the whole spirit was taken away. So 20 years later, he needed to go to the same city for some reason. And this time he only slept 28 minutes. So he made up for 2 minutes. So he was rejoicing. He says, the 2 minutes that I lost, I made up. And they say the whole city was happy. The whole city rejoiced that they had given the Vilna Gaon back his 2 minutes. So the point is, I mean, everybody knows this, the Vilna Gaon, his hasmada was unimaginable. And yet, this is what he says. Just as water, if what is in the ground is something good, you'll get something good. And if what's in the ground is something bad, you'll get something bad. In Torah, if you have within you good midos, kindness, compassion, modesty, the Torah will make those midos better and stronger and deeper. Well, that part is non-controversial. But the controversial part is the other way. If you have in your personality arrogance, gaiva, and selfishness, the learning of the Torah may make those qualities even stronger. The Baal Gaiva, this is the part that the person said he didn't believe, the Baal Gaiva might become a bigger Baal Gaiva by his learning. And therefore the Vilna Gaon made the point that you have to couple the learning of Torah with direct work on your Midos Tovos through Musar and the like. And that is why it is said that although the official founder of the Musar movement was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, but indirectly it was the Vilna Gaon, and indeed this can be shown even in a linear way. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's hidden Rebbe was a man who was not famous, but Rabbi Yisrael Salanter considered him to be his Rebbe, Rav Zundel of Salanter, who was a hidden tzaddik that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to follow around as a young adolescent. And he learned from Rav Zundel sitkus and midos and yiras shemayim. Rav Zundel was a great, great Talmud Chacham, but he was not a Rav. He worked as a peddler. Rav Zundel of Salant was a Talmud of Rav Chaim of Elazhen. And Rav Chaim of Elazhen is a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. So really, it's not at all accidental that this concept of Musar, of working on midos, comes really from the Vilna Gaon. And in fact, the first Sefer of the Vilna Gaon that was printed after his death was the Sefer Mishlei, the Commentary on Proverbs, which is a book of Musar. Only afterwards, the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch and his other writings were published. The Vilna Gaon considered this to be the most important work that needed to be meforsim. Now, let me explain. There was another Shita, which to some degree many people hold, that the learning of Torah itself will make you a better person. So when you're learning, you know, Rashi, a Tosfos, a Ramban, you will become a better person without having to work on your personality at all. It'll happen mimela. There is such a shita. In fact, this is the shita of Brisk. This was Rav Chaim's shita. This is still the shita of Brisk. And in yeshivas, we talk about it one way or the other. I just want to point out that the Vilna Gaon himself does not seem to agree with that. And that's what the Vilna Gaon says. Torah is kamayim. Amazing thing. Torah is like water. If you have goodness in you, you become better. You have negatives in you, the negatives become stronger. Torah has the koach of tzmicha. So based on this Vilna Gaon, I would add this. This is my addition. The Vilna Gaon doesn't say it on this. That this is why the whole Torah is compared to Parah Aduma. Because Parah Aduma embraces the paradox that it makes the Tohar Tameh, it makes the Tameh Tahar, and it makes the Tahar Tameh. Meaning, it can produce something good, and it produces something negative at the same time. That is what the Torah is, right? The Torah can produce negatives to those that have Midos Ros, and it produces positives to those that have Midos Tovos. And therefore, the paradox of Parah Aduma is a paradox that exists within the framework of the Torah itself. Right? That's the idea of Zeis Achukas HaTorah. Now, let me just say, though, in defense of the Shita, that learning Torah alone will make you a better person, let me do quote a Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi darshens a pasuk in which HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Halvai Aisi Yazva. Even if the Jewish people would leave me, but they would cleave unto my Torah, HaMa'or Sheba, the light of the Torah, Machziro Lemutav, will eventually bring them back to me, even if a person leaves God totally. So, as I say, apparently this was a machlokas in Chazal. There was a machlokas in Chazal if the Torah learning itself has a koach to purify a person. But Rav Chaim Volozhiner, who was, of course, the Vilna Gaon's Talmud, writes in the Nefesh HaChaim a very, very interesting, I thought. He writes that we find in the Pasuk, Yiras Hashem, he Otsoro. Yiras Hashem is the storehouse. Otsar, like a treasury, is the storehouse of Torah. So he says, what is a storehouse? A storehouse is that which preserves and safeguards my wealth. So Yiras Hashem preserves and safeguards your Torah. Without Yiras Hashem, your Torah flies away. But here's what Rav Chaim Volozhiner says. Rav Chaim Volozhiner says that you see in Perek HaMafkid that when I sell you grain, I am allowed to include in the grain a certain percentage of soil, because that keeps the grain fresh. The soil from which the grain grew is a preservative. So if you agree to buy, you know, pounds of grain or a ton of grain, part of that can be the soil. And if you look at the cheshbon, you will see that the cheshbon basically is 1/24th, meaning if you're buying 24 pounds of grain, there can be 1 pound of soil. So instead of 24, you get 23 pounds and a pound of soil. So Rav Chaim says the following. We see from the Gemara that 1/24th is the preservative of the grain. So if Torah is called the grain, and Yiras Hashem is called the preservative, so Rav Chaim suggests a mathematical formula that the amount of time that one should spend in Musar learning and in Tikkun HaMidos should be 1/24th of their total learning time. Now, this is very, very fascinating, because a standard yeshiva schedule in Europe, in Vlozhin, was 12 hours. Many people, of course, learned more than that, but 12 hours. So if you think about it, 1/24th of 12 hours is a half an hour. So this is the source of the minhag in yeshivas, Musar yeshivas, that you should devote one half an hour a day to Musar, because it literally follows the idea of the 1/24th. You see where I get 1/24th? Because again, Yiras Hashem is the preservative of your grain. Torah is your grain. We see from the Mishnah and HaMafkid that preservatives are 1/24th. If we assume a 12-hour day, 1/24th is a half an hour. Right? 1/24th of 12 is a half an hour. Right? That's the makor. Now, the truth of the matter is, though, as the Chafetz Chaim himself pointed out, as the doros get weaker and weaker and weaker, perhaps we sometimes need more Musar. So I wouldn't say learn Musar 6 hours a day. But perhaps we need a lot of work. We need a lot of work. You know, we live in a world of selfishness, of gaiva, of arrogance, and the Tikkun HaMidos is very important. And the Chafetz Chaim said that Limud HaTorah alone, and this really fits what the Gra said, but it's said in a different way, Limud HaTorah alone is the diet for a healthy soul. If your soul is healthy and strong, then Torah learning will feed it and nurture it. But if someone has a sick soul, just like you need medicines for a sick soul, and a regular diet is not going to work, you need medicine. So too, for people that have choli hanefesh, you need augmentation by Musar and Tikkun Hamidos and everything else. That's really, that's essentially saying what the Vilna Gaon says, that you've got to purify yourself inside, and then the Torah is going to elevate you and sanctify you. Yeah.
How does the idea that through dying Torah you can improve the Midos fit with Aramaic's poem he said it, but it's harder to change one Midah than to learn the whole of Shas? So.
Well, keep in mind, that you're asking a kasha from Bedavka the Shita that disagreed with that approach. That memra is Rabbi Shaul Salanter's memra. Rabbi Shaul Salanter was the one that said learning Torah is not enough. You know, now, what I'm saying is there was a big machlokas. We don't realize this, but because Rabbi Shaul Salanter is such a great gadol, we just assume that everybody went along with it. That was not true. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was really the gadol ador, was not in favor at all. Now, when we say he wasn't in favor of Musar, that doesn't mean he wasn't in favor of Midos Tovos. I mean, that of course is an absurdity. We don't mean that, but he was against the notion of adding things to the Seder HaYeshiva. He said that Limud HaTorah will straighten out the perversities in human nature. Rav Yisrael Salanter said, no, we have a special avaida in rectifying our Midos. Yeah.
Many proofs where we see like people who know the whole Shas and the whole school Avo, but the Midas are they have still like animals.
Well, again, I mean, you know.
That's the proof of the God, no?
Well, again, this is what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter felt. I don't know if he spoke quite as harshly as you just did, but Rabbi Yisrael Salanter did feel that he looked at the world, and he saw that even people who were very, very learned were not kind, they were not generous, we include ourselves in all of this, they behaved with gaiva, with arrogance, and the like, and therefore he saw from his own observation that there needed to be a direct working on a person's midos. It does not happen automatically. And again, the concept, once again, it's based on the Gra. Torah is like water. If you have those midos, the Torah will make it so much better. But lehepach, it could be makalkel as well. Yeah.
I'm wondering if the Rav can tell us, maybe I missed it. Where is the source in Chazal that says that Torah fixes one's midos?
That Torah fixes one's midos?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are many statements, but again, they could be interpreted different ways. The most famous one is a statement that says, Hashem says, Barasi Yetzer Hara, I created the Yetzer Hara, but Barasi Torah Tavlin, I created the Torah as a refuah, a healing for the Yetzer Hara. Yeah.
Sorry to cut the Rav short. I was thinking maybe then on that source, the Gemara in Brachot, in the ninth verse, says Hashem created the man with two Yetzerim.
Yeah.
And I think the Rashi says that's to the Yetzer of Machshava and one with the Yetzer of Midos.
Right.
Like, excuse it towards bad Midos. But many of us need to appease the machloket. Torah would maybe fix a person up in machshava. Yes, it lines a person to think how a human being should think.
Yeah.
But not maybe his midos, which is more of an neshama dictum.
Yeah, I think that's what the Vilna Gaon would say. The Torah can obviously correct intellectual deficiencies, misperceptions, wrong ideas. But the truth of the matter is, a lot of our stumbling blocks are not because we have erroneous ideas, but because we have taivas and urges. In other words, like this. Most of us know, it's not good to get angry, it's not good to scream, it's not good to yell, it's not good to lose our temper, it's not good to be cruel. We know that these things are wrong, but we do it anyway. So the issue is not, oh gee, I need to understand that getting angry is wrong, right? Rather, this is a whole other chachma. So kind of improving your ideas are not automatically going to improve your actual behavior. That's a separate yetzer hara. So this is the origin of the Musar. Actually, maybe some other time we'll talk about the fact that Rav Yisrael Salanter had different Talmidim, and the different Talmidim had different approaches. The altar of Kelim is a city in Lithuania, Slobodka, Navardic, these are different approaches to personality developments. But the basic idea is that Rabbi Sol Salanter brought to our generation the conscious working of Tikkun HaMidos. And they say that there was a story. They say that in the first years of his life, until he was like 25, he was an Eloy, and he didn't have any particular emphasis on Musar. He was just a standard, brilliant, potential Gadol B'Torah. And the story goes that he was in Vilna, and he was made Rosh Hashiva. And then he discovered that they hired him to replace another person who they basically fired, who was a great Rosh Hashiva himself. And Rav Sol Salanter would not take a job that resulted in somebody being fired to make room for him. And apparently in Vilna, we don't know all the details because he never spoke about it, but apparently in Vilna, it turned out to be a bitter, bitter machlokas in which each side was insulting the other side. And that brought, in a very vivid way, to Rabbi Yisrael, the idea that even great Talmidei Chachamim were capable of hatred and machlokas. And they say, people say, that was that experience in particular that pushed him to develop the idea of Musar, of personality development and the like. They say the same with the Chafetz Chaim. Like, what made the Chafetz Chaim so into Lashon Hara, so to speak? Like, why did he write so many Svarim? Why did he... Why? I mean, Chafetz Chaim wrote many, many things, the Mishnah Berurah, among other things, but you know, Shmiras HaLashon was his... The mitzvah he emphasized above everything else. What pushed him to do that mitzvah? They say, as a young man in Radin, there was apparently an awful machlokas in the city in which there was so much Lashon Hara going on and families were destroyed. And by his personal observation of the destruction of Lashon Hara, he said he saw it as his mission in life to teach people about its evils and warn people away from it. So often it's the personal experience that pushes a person in a certain direction. Yeah.
But how would the Vilna Gaon's opinion be different from the 30-minute shita?
No, I would actually say, I mean, it's really, the 30-minute shita is Rav Chaim Volozhin. So Rav Chaim Volozhin is probably the same as the Vilna Gaon. All I'm saying is the Vilna Gaon did not quantify it. The Vilna Gaon just made a point, Torah learning is not enough, you need Tikkun HaMidos. Now the Vilna Gaon doesn't tell you, you know, how much time that is. Rav Chaim Volozhin tried to quantify it a little bit more.
I also remember hearing somewhere that if you only have like a small amount of time each day to learn,
yep,
you should learn Musar.
Yeah, that's a famous remark of Rishon Salanter. Somebody said, I only have a half an hour. Rishon Salanter has many, many famous one-liners as well as longer things. I only have a half an hour. I learn Gemara and Musar. So he says, if you learn Musar, because then you'll see you have more than half an hour. Because you'll understand all the time that we waste and the like. Yeah. You should do what? Then I don't hear.
Learn Hasidut half an hour.
Well,
I don't know what I want to know about the literature people more learn Musa and the Hasidim guys say you should learn Hasidut and not Musa.
Well, let me put it this way. I have to go now. Maybe we'll talk about the difference between Musar and Chassidut. The truth of the matter is, though, there is a common denominator. They are very different approaches. They are very different approaches. And which approach is best for you is an individual decision. The Tzad HaShaveh, though, the common denominator is, it focuses directly on how I serve Hashem by being a better person. Musar and Chassidus may approach that question through different perspectives, but what I'm saying is, it is a direct focus on my Avodas Hashem, as opposed to my abstract Gemara learning, which, as vitally important as it is not directly dealing with that issue. And the Vilna Gaon says you need to devote some time to directly confronting my Midos. Now, Musar tends to do so in a more self-critical vein. So for some people, Musar gets them depressed, and there indeed is a cheshbon not to pursue that. Chassidus tends to do it in a more upbeat, optimistic vein. All right, those are different mahalchim, but they are the same in that they focus directly on how I serve Hashem in a better way, right? So Chassidus, Musar, you know, it used to be in the Litvishi Yeshiva, it's a very, very sharp division that Chassidus was not allowed in the Litvishi Yeshiva. How can you bring in Chassidus? What are you doing? But it's interesting, there's kamat one person who gets the credit for bringing Chassidus into the yeshiva world. That is Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler, the Michtam Eliyahu, became the Mashgiach of Panovich. He was a Baal Musar, a classical Baal Musar, and the classical Baal Musar never brought in Chassidus, but he began to bring in Tanya and other Sifrei Chassidus. And the old Bali Musar that he had gone to yeshiva with, Rabbi Chaska Levenstein, those great people, they didn't like it. They didn't like it at all. They said, what are you doing? You're bringing in foreign things into here. But he did it, and because he said that the generation needed, even non-Chassidim needed Chassidus, and it's now it's now very makabel that in all yeshivas people bring in this, especially Sfas Emes, Reb Sadok, Nesiva Shalom, a lot of people like Shem Mishmuel, a certain genre, not all Chassidus. There's a certain genre of Chassidus that you might call also has an intellectual and analytical bent, so it gains a hechsher in the Lipshitz yeshivas. And give credit. It was Rav Dessler in Eretz Yisrael and Rav Huttner in America. Those are the two people that brought Chassidus into the non-Chassidish world. Oh, it's also a third person, also Rav Gedalia Shor. Gedalia Shor in Torah Vidas, because he was a Chassidish, a Talmud of Rav Aaron Cutler, so he brought it in. Okay, have a good chat. Yep.